within the range of simple children's language.
You mean even though the pre-primer or the primer was written or was attempted to be written in the cultural terminology of the people, mm-hmm. it still would be inadequate because it was not translatable?
It was translatable, but when the translation was completed, it wasn't the kind of text that you would have developed had you begun the project from the point of view of Navajo exclusively.
Somewhere I've run across this criticism.
Yeah.
I don't recall where.
Well, it may come ultimately from me, because it doesn't matter. It's major critics, and I'm trying to prevent the continued use of this same material now.
So.
I consider the material that the girls are producing out here to be far superior, and I would like to see it used now, since it's possible to produce this kind of material. But now and then, for that matter, I make no claims of being an expert in the preparation of children's literature, so...
it's a little out of your field.
Yes, it's just a little out of my field.
Oh, were you doing the translating, though?
Yes. I was doing it often with William Morgan and with other Navajo assistants that were available at the mm-hmm. time.
Was this true of all of the books, that the primer, pre-primer books that were being written at the time? They were first written in English and then translated?
In this initial period, yes.
Of the late 30s and early 40s.
And then in the early 40s, we took a slightly different tack. We took Navajo stories, these coyote stories,
yes,
and things of that nature, and we simplified them by, instead of telling them the way an adult would tell them, we told them in terms of just little short sentences. I don't think very attractively, but nonetheless, it was an effort to overcome this business of translation. And it was paraphrasing. You could just take a text of a story and you could extract from it the salient features and ideas and then express them just in short lines. So Coyote said, let it rain, and that sort of thing.
Right, sure.
Went down the line. And you had the skeleton then of the story.
Well, would you say, how would you evaluate this program of BD's?
The bilingual program?
Right.
Well, I felt that there was a great deal of merit, and I still do, to the use of native languages to communicate with adult people, for that matter, who can't speak any other language. It's mm-hmm. the only one they know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only medium through which they can get a clear concept of whatever is involved. Secondly, I do feel that it's logical that a child entering school and learning the mechanics of reading and writing, which is quite a mechanical skill in itself, it can do so more easily if he understands and knows the language that he's writing than he can if he's learning the skills of reading and writing in one he can't understand. I can't quite conceive of my own child learning reading and writing more rapidly if I put my child in a Greek school where he learned to read and write in Greek without knowing Greek. I feel that there's merit to it, and I think that BD's approach was very sound. There were many, many constraints at the period, however. The obvious being that there were very, very few, if any, Navajo teachers in the late 1930s and early 40s. There might have been one here and there, but there were very, very few. Many of them had gone through school in a preceding period when the use of the native language was absolutely forbidden, so they didn't even have a very good command of it. In the absence of native speakers in the schools and themselves, it became very difficult to teach written Navajo to children, of course. There was no one to teach. I used to go around the reservation and hold classes.
Oh, did you?
And during this period, the early 40s, but I would be the only one that would be available to teach even children how to read and write in their own language. So this kind of constraint, of course, was really, really imposed a terrific obstacle to the idea of bilingual education. In other words, Beattie's project was perhaps just a little bit before its time in the late 30s and the early 40s. Now, perhaps the need is declining, but the situation, the climate, has improved drastically. If we had this, if we had had in the early 1940s the proportion of Navajo teachers in working in the schools that we have presently, it could have really gone forward very rapidly. And we had Navajo assistants. I had Navajo assistants who carried on adult classes in various parts of the reservation, teaching people how to read the newspaper, so that they could be kept abreast of things that were taking place. Well, there are many other factors too. Back in the 1930s and 1940s, that entered the picture as a constraint. Primarily going back to the educational policies of the pre-Collier period, where de-Indianization and deculturation of Indians was a primary objective of educators. Their Christianization was one of the principal objectives, and not necessarily through the use of the native language. They would use it where it was absolutely essential, and that accounts for the attempts to translate the Bible and that sort of thing. But certainly the policies of educators in the period before Collier were not directed at the continued use of native languages. So after Collier came in, there, of course, were many conflicts between him and Beattie and the new order in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the new set of policies and the people that had been closely identified with the preceding policies. So they took the position, why do you want to teach the children Navajo, or why do you want to learn to read and write Navajo? Learn to read and write English. Obvious was that adults couldn't possibly learn to read and write English. It's too complex to teach them just on basis of sporadic classes now and then. And
did you encounter some of this conflict?
Oh yeah, I was.
Did you?
No,
I've never heard anyone talk about this before.
No, it was quite an interesting thing, of course. It was just a difference in opinion, a difference
sure.
in basic approach to the idea of dealing with minority people such as the Navajo. And
was what until they began, of course, hiring new teachers as they started doing right away. Would you say that overwhelmingly the people who had long experience in teaching were opposed to Collier's new policies?
I think there were lots of them that were, yes. And you recall at that period there were not enough schools really to accommodate all of the Navajo children.
Mm,
and
yes, indeed.
The day schools didn't go very far in terms of grade levels. So the missionary schools on the reservation still were in a dominant role, especially as it related to more advanced education, that is high school level education. And the missionaries, they had lots of followers, and they had them not only among teachers and bureau schools, they had them of course among traders and among elements of the public around the reservation who agreed that all Indians should become Christians and should discontinue their own customs and language. So you had these two camps, and they were pretty sharply delineated as I saw them.
Do you feel that, I have encountered this, I believe, do you feel that the missionaries were influential in opposing Collier's policies outside of education, such as the grazing?
I think the missionaries had a following, and they were quite vocal, and so also did the trader, who was in contact with the Navajo and did have a medium for communication with him. And the trader, of course, felt that his own economy was jeopardized by such things as livestock reduction, because basically the Navajos were the pastoral people at the time, and the trader's relationship was largely in the form of wool and lambs in exchange for commodities, and the trader felt himself endangered economically, so the traders became by and large enemies of the Collier administration and of Collier. And of course I don't feel that Collier and the people that he had on his staff who were concerned about the economy of reservations, the resources of reservations, were very well advised in moving as rapidly as they did in the direction of livestock reduction. In other words, I think that was really idiotic. It was necessary. People had known that it was necessary since the 1890s. And if you go through the reports of the superintendents in those old letter books up there at Window Rock, you'll find recurrent references to the decline in physical resources on the reservation and to the worsening condition of livestock. It was really obvious that something had to be done, but nobody knew what to do. And finally you find what was the Assistant Commissioner Merritt meeting with the Navajos in 1928 and talking about livestock reduction, the need to control numbers, but he had no concept of what he was even talking about. And then a few years later, of course, Collier comes into the picture. We get a national policy implemented through the Department of the Interior aimed at soil conservation, and there was lots of money available during the Depression years. Well, this whole combination of factors made it possible to move in on the Navajo situation very rapidly. And since Collier didn't know how long he was going to be in office and felt very strongly that this had to be done, there had to be a diversification of Navajo economy immediately to save what was left, he sanctioned a program that he attempted to implement in entirely too short a period of time. Had it been a long-range program designed to be carried out concurrently with education and concurrently with other types of diversification of the reservation economy over a period of, let's say, two decades, it would have made sense, and I think it would have taken place and taken place quite successfully.
But what about the war?
Well, of course, that injected something else into the economic picture on the reservation,
right,
because a lot of people went outside the reservation.
And actually,
during the
in
war
a way,
years,
didn't it do a little bit of what he wanted unintentionally?
To some extent, it did.
Uh-huh.
It did result in reductions of livestock. But unfortunately, when the war ended and people came back, they immediately began to build up their livestock numbers because there was nothing else to do. And so it went back to where it was previously, really.
Did you know Collier?
Yes.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've become very interested in the man, of course, who is going over such a long period of time, and I have found myself characterizing him, you know, just from what I've read, really. I haven't talked to him.